loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the Trump administration announced last night that it would be unable to comply with a court order directing it to reunify all migrant children under the age of 5 who were separated from their families at the border. A Justice Department spokesman said the administration may be able to unify 54 of the 102 children by today. Also, a court ruled against a Trump policy of long-term detention for immigrants. Next, President Trump arrives in Brussels today to attend the annual NATO summit. But instead of unity, European leaders expect Trump to berate them for not spending enough money on defense. And those European allies are afraid that Trump will threaten to withdraw U.S. troops from Europe if they don't spend more. Then, U.S. Ambassador to Germany Rick Grenell yesterday urged Berlin to block Iran's request to withdraw $350 million of its own money from German banks and send it to Iran before sanctions take effect. Grenell came under fire a month ago after he said that he was seeking to boost anti-establishment parties around Europe. Many German politicians have called for him to be expelled from the country. And then President Trump today pardoned two ranchers from southeastern Oregon who were sentenced to serve prison time on two separate occasions for setting brush fires to clear public lands. The return to prison of father and son Dwight and Steve Hammond sparked the 41-day occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in early 2016, in which a protester was killed and an FBI agent was charged with lying about that shooting. And finally, Mark Zuckerberg is one of the wealthiest people on Earth, with a net worth of an estimated $74.2 billion. But he and his company have come under increasing fire for gross violations of user privacy. Should Zuckerberg resign as the head of Facebook? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to immigration. The Trump administration announced last night that it would be unable to comply with a court order directing it to reunify all migrant children under the age of 5 who were separated from their families at the border. A Justice Department spokesman said the administration may be able to unify 54 of the 102 children by today. Also, a court ruled against a Trump policy of long-term detention for immigrants. We're joined from Philadelphia by David Bennion. He's an immigration lawyer and executive director of the Free Migration Project. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
David, explain the legality of this. Let's say that the Trump administration can't reunify these children in time, and they say that we just can't do it. Then what? Do they get away with it? Do they get an extension? Is there some kind of a penalty?
Well, it's going to be up to the judge and to an extent the ACLU, the other party in the action, to decide whether or not to grant an extension, what any penalty might be for missing the deadline, as it seems almost certain that they're going to miss today's deadline. And how does all of this play into the next deadline, which is in another 2 weeks, where they're supposed to have reunited a much larger number of children, those children over the age of 5.
Yeah, you know, there's so much work to do. This is just a small drop in the bucket. We're only talking about 102 children.
There are thousands of kids,
of people, right.
David, there are like something like in this, from just the last few months, there's 2,300 children who have been forcibly separated and jailed or put elsewhere, separated from their folks?
Yes, the total number is around 3,000, but it's a rough estimate. The government's own figures are always changing. And to be honest, it's not been a priority for them to keep accurate records of who the children are, who the parents are, where the children and parents are, for the purpose of family reunification, because their number one priority is to deport families, and if that means separating them, then that's all in service of their number one priority. And so it's no surprise that it's been a chaotic mess.
It really has been, and I'm surprised, frankly, that there's not more of a public outcry, especially in light of the fact that a court has ruled on this, and the court has ruled that this is wrong, and that these children have to be reunited immediately. These are children, in many cases, unable to speak because they're so young, who are not allowed to have an attorney represent them in court. And so you take a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old into a courtroom and stand him in front of a judge and expect him to defend himself and take care of himself. Well, That's impossible. So the only alternative, of course, is to bring the family back together, and we can't even get that done.
Before David responds to that, I want to just ask you, David, the Trump administration and Jeff Sessions obviously wanted to separate families as a public demonstration of what's going to happen to families should they seek to use, you know, the port of entry or any other means to try to find or file an asylum claim. They wanted to do that on purpose. But the Obama administration earlier had set up these family detention centers. And also, I believe it was for unaccompanied children, made the argument and successfully argued in, I think, in a federal court that children should not be provided legal representation. Talk about that, if you would, as well.
Yes, it's a huge problem that children who are not in court with their parents, they're alone, are expected to represent themselves in what's an incredibly complex and high-stakes legal proceeding. But unfortunately, there is no guaranteed right to free counsel for anyone in immigration proceedings, including for young children, as young as one or even infants in some cases. And so at least when a child is with a parent, they're better able to access counsel. Again, not free counsel for the parents either, but or the family units, but counsel that has to be paid for or come from nonprofit sources, which are few and far between. But to expect a child to represent themselves in a life and death situation when sometimes they don't even know what country they're from at the age of two or three, they are not able to articulate basic things like that, much less a full asylum claim. And so, unfortunately, many children are ordered deported under the system that we have. And I should also note that reunifying the families doesn't solve their problems because the government, their main goal is to deport these reunited families and short circuit the rightful asylum process. And that's what they're doing even today.
Let's talk about what, because I think most people in the United States who are not immigrants or not haven't had the experience of seeking asylum, they don't really understand what the process is. I mean, Donald Trump is telling his supporters, like, there's a horde of people, you know, marching across the border, invading the country, blah, blah, blah. That's not true. But just talk about how the process is supposed to work. You have a claim of asylum. You say you're fleeing persecution or fleeing violence. What's supposed to happen? And it would seem to me, based on international law, it's not supposed to be a foundationally punitive exercise whereby you're immediately separated from your kids or immediately detained. Because, again, we don't want families to be locked up together. That's not what the goal is here. Go ahead.
Under the best of circumstances, an asylum case is very difficult because the law has become more and more hostile to these types of claims, especially when we have Attorney General Jeff Sessions actively trying to undermine existing asylum law, for instance, for victims of domestic violence. And so basically, it's very hard to do without counsel. Once you're detained, it becomes much harder to obtain counsel, to have an attorney who's able to go out to these remote detention centers and adequately prepare a case or even know that you're there. The judges have incredible discretion as to whether to deny or grant asylum cases, and the denial rate, which is carefully tabulated across the country, ranges from 3% for a judge in New York City to, in some years, literally 100% denial rate for some judges, and the judges at the detention centers almost uniformly have the higher denial rates. And so, essentially, a person comes in, they do a sort of screening interview for the asylum office to determine whether they have a valid claim. And only if they pass that screening interview is the case referred to a judge. And essentially, there's a gathering of evidence. The lawyer helps the client make the legal arguments to try to persuade the judge that whether or not the person qualifies for asylum. We know that these families are coming from the Northern Triangle in Central America, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, mostly. And we see the violence down there. We see gender-based violence, gang-based violence, and it's a life or death situation that is driving these people to come to the United States. They should qualify for asylum, but our government, unfortunately, is using every trick in the book to press them to give up their claims or make it so that they can't win.
We're speaking with David Bennion. He's an immigration lawyer and executive director of the Free Migration Project. David, on this show, we say so often that we have to rely on the courts to make some of these terrible policies right, because we can't rely on our elected officials, either on Capitol Hill or in the White House. You're painting a different picture here, where you can't even count on the courts. So how are these people going to finally find justice? Is there a way for them to find justice?
I think through public support. The public outcry over the family separation policy was a terrible phenomenon, but it was encouraging to see the public stand up and say no. And so I think that's critical, because it's provided the context and background for the president's decisions and also the court's rulings. I'm sure that they take into consideration the dynamic and the political discussion in the country. But yes, the courts, unfortunately, won't always save us, and certainly won't save these families who are applying for asylum. And in my view, what is needed is a revamp of the asylum law to bring the U.S. into compliance with its treaty obligations under international human rights law.
And what are those? And what is the treaty?
Basically, you're not supposed to send families or individuals back into situations where they will be tortured or killed or persecuted based on certain protected characteristics under the asylum laws. And essentially, it's been death by a thousand cuts with our immigration policy, where bit by bit, we've chipped away at the actual lawful implementation of those obligations under international law to make it so that in many cases, they're practically worthless.
That's the voice of David Bennion. David is the Free Migration Project's executive director. You can read his work and the work of others with the Free Migration Project by going to freemigrationproject.org. David, in our last 30 seconds, you have a piece up on your website. I'm looking at it now. Why we should abolish ICE Council. Talk about that. 30 seconds real quick, actually.
Sure. So we've heard a lot of calls to abolish ICE, mostly talking about the deportation officers, but also ICE has prosecuting attorneys in immigration court, and they unfortunately are often acting to restrict access to asylum and to other forms of immigration relief. These are civil proceedings. They're not criminal proceedings. They bring no right to free counsel. And so if immigrants don't have the right to an attorney, the government shouldn't either. And we should pattern immigration court more like other administrative proceedings without guaranteed counsel for the government. It's the only fair and just way to approach the issue.
Okay, we're out of time, so we'll leave it there. We were joined from Philadelphia by David Bennion. He's an immigration lawyer and executive director of the Free Migration Project. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
President Trump arrives in Brussels today to attend the annual NATO summit. But instead of unity, European leaders expect Trump to berate them for not spending enough money on defense. And those European allies are afraid that Trump will threaten to withdraw U.S. troops from Europe if they don't spend more. We're joined from Sweden by Dr. Jan Åberg. He's the director of the Transnational Foundation for Peace and Future Research. Dr. Åberg, welcome back to the show. It's been a long time.
Thank you so much.
You know, these NATO summits take place every year, and every year the final communique talks about how the alliance has never been stronger and that there's always complete unity. This one doesn't look like there's going to be unity. How do you think this plays out in the coming days?
Well, I think it's going to be a very problematic meeting. Some kind of surprises, of bad mood, a bad atmosphere, and the conflict over the Atlantic is deeper than it has been for many years, if not uniquely so. And I think if you want the larger perspective on it, I would have one, and that's simply much of the Western world, the West as we used to call it, is, I wouldn't say falling apart, but it's getting weaker. And that is something that causes a lot of internal problems too. You see leadership problems in the European Union. You see a completely different type of leadership, if we can call it that, in Washington. And we see a NATO that, of course, is influenced by that. There's no way NATO could not be influenced by the helter-skelter and the crisis of the West. Now, if you take the concrete case, this issue about burden sharing over the Atlantic is old hat in the sense that there has always been a discussion about that. And it's irrelevant in my mind, in my view, because anybody who studied these things know that the U.S. is in Europe to protect the United States first and foremost. It's a forward defense position. That is the interest they have. It's not because of the blue eyes or the humanity or whatever of Europe. Secondly, a 2% of the gross national product is a completely bizarre, foolish idea. That means if a country gets a better economy, it should pay more to the common defense. The only relevant thing we should have is the defense forces, if we want to have them at all, are they appropriate in relationship to some intellectually defensible and reasonably serious threat analysis? Third, there is no way you can get the European countries to pay 2% of their gross national product because they don't feel that threat that the United States had pumped into their minds. So I think this burden-sharing thing is I think the 2% is and there's no seriousness. It's an intellectual disarmament completely because that's not the way you run security politics. It's a marketization, you know. It's a way of talking money, saying if you spend this and that money, we've done something about the problem. No, you haven't.
On this issue of 2% of gross national product that the White House wants European allies to pay, is this a situation where we have an irresistible force meeting an immovable object, or is there room for negotiation here?
Well, I think that there has been a decision made, a pledge by all the countries at some earlier meeting that they would do 2%. And I don't know why anybody said yes to do that. The far majority is under the 2%. I think it's five or six countries that, including, of course, the United States, which is on 3.6% or something like that. I don't understand why anybody went along, except that, you know, it's words, 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 and no reality. Or they went along to get rid of a conflict with Trump. But, of course, the man is coming back and say, you said, and that's where he has a point.
Dr. Orberg, I want to jump in and let our audience know that this demand for the 2% did not come from Donald Trump. This was Barack Obama.
That's right.
And I think what happened is the NATO countries said yes to Obama because they figured he's just talking. He's not like it's not going to become a thing. He said it. He demanded it. And they said, OK, sure. Expecting nobody to follow through with it. That gave Donald Trump this cudgel to beat the European NATO countries over the head. You said you were going to pledge 2%. You're not doing it. Again, I think you're right, though. NATO is not there. NATO does not exist to defend Europe. NATO is, you called it a forward defense. I would even call it a forward offense because at least in the late 1940s, when NATO took shape, it was competing against the socialist bloc countries who had the Warsaw Pact. You had the symmetry of two military alliances anchored by a superpower, the Soviet Union on one side and the U.S. on the other. The Soviet Union is gone. The socialist bloc nations are gone. The Warsaw Pact is gone. I mean, why shouldn't NATO be abolished? I mean, it really is, it seems to me, just a self-serving relic of the Cold War.
Okay, let me take up a couple of points here. First of all, exactly what you said is what we said in 89 in our foundation. Close down NATO because the raison d'etre of NATO has been all the time that there was a Warsaw Pact. Secondly, the Warsaw Pact was created 6 years after NATO, so NATO was not a response to anything. NATO was 49, the Warsaw Pact was in 55. Three, you might say it's a fence, but what is really interesting, and everybody has forgotten that, I advise everybody who listens to this, go to the net and Google or whatever. No, don't use Google because they check you. Find out where you can read NATO's treaty from 49, and you will see that it's a copy of the United Nations Charter. Everything that NATO de facto does is the opposite of what it was supposed to do. It was a purely defensive alliance where one would come to the rescue of all and all would come to the rescue of one within Europe or in case of an attack on North America. It was an alliance that would be created to protect democracy and freedom, and it would be purely defensive. It would respect international law, and it would always adhere to the UN Charter idea of making peace by peaceful means. This is what today's NATO is operating on, and point after point, year after year, war after war, it's doing the opposite. It's actually criminalizing its own constitution. That's one reason I think it should be closed down. The only way it has been able to survive was by doing the opposite of what its own charter said it should do. And then that's when I think legal experts and others should begin to look into how long time can a major organization do these things and violate its own charter.
I agree with you 100%, actually. And you look at NATO, it's NATO, North Atlantic Treaty Organization, purportedly around defense of the North Atlantic. You have NATO in Afghanistan. You know, we have NATO bombing Libya. These are not North Atlantic countries.
Right. And these are not defensive actions either.
No.
NATO has just set up an office in Kuwait. NATO started its out-of-area operation in Yugoslavia by violating international law and bombing without a mandate from the United Nations Security Council and creating a Kosovo that is still a failed state. I mean, all these things is violations of its own charter.
Yeah, I hear you. Dr. Jan Orberg is our guest. Donald Tusk, the president of the EU, former head of state in Poland, said about Donald Trump coming to this summit, "Dear America, appreciate your allies. After all, you don't have that many." He then went on, "The U.S. doesn't have and won't have a better ally than the EU. We spend on defense much more than Russia and as much as China. I hope you have no doubt this is an investment in our security, which cannot be said with confidence about Russian and Chinese spending." So while Donald Tusk is kind of humorously taunting Donald Trump, that the sort of organic or foundational part of Donald Tusk's position is actually pretty warlike, given the fact that Europe isn't under imminent threat. Russia's not invading Europe. China's not invading Europe. The U.S. has tens of thousands of troops that continue to occupy Europe 70 years after World War II. The U.S. and the European countries have advanced nuclear weapons throughout Europe. I mean, come on. I mean, this is not a progressive position. Why is Donald Tusk doing this? Who is he actually representing? 2 minutes left.
No, I just think that he's playing on this anger against Trump and ridiculing Trump and all that, which is a cheap stuff to do. But the real thing is that Russia's military expenditures are 8% of the 29 NATO members. The rest is propaganda. The rest is a way of surviving. And that's where we're back to the point of departure. When you have no more mission, the real mission being the one you had in 49 as a defensive group, not threatening anyone. When you don't have that anymore, when you have left that, you have to invent enemies. You have to invent ways in which you look like you have a raison d'etre and define the world in such a way that what you do, the utility of what you do is maximized. This is what it does now, and it's also all a sign of an alliance or a way of thinking more, I would say, that is on its deathbed. The future world does not need things like NATO, nuclear weapons, interventionism, and militarism out of democratic control. It needs something completely new. And that's why I've argued that NATO should either close down completely or be turned into a non-weapons humanitarian organization with its transport and communication facilities, or be the embryo, completely new embryo for a European security system aided by OSCE and related to the United Nations. There are tons of ways we can use that organization for something else, but take away all the weapons from it.
The idea that Obama demanded and now Trump is demanding that these economies, no matter what, spend 2% of their entire gross national product to buy weapons that can only be used to kill people, can be only used in war, when actually what people need, the things that people need, all of those can be purchased with this. I mean, when we talk about 2% of a country's gross national product or gross domestic product, we're talking about tens of billions of dollars, and just arbitrarily say, yeah, spend more on death and destruction rather than what people need. The whole thing is gross. It should be abolished.
No, but that's what I couldn't agree more with you as a peace researcher with 40 years of experience and some knowledge about how nonviolence and intelligent conflict management could work. This is just run by the military-industrial media academic complex, what I call MIMAC, and that's outside democratic control. And in 61, Dwight D. Eisenhower said that in his farewell speech, and it's much, much worse today than it was at that time. There's no reason to have all these wars. And by the way, it's fun that here is a point where Trump obviously supports what Obama said. He spent most of his time demolishing everything Obama said and did. But here is one where he sees it fit to promote Obama's policy.
This spans political parties in the United States, and you can't get relief from one or from the other because they agree on everything. But we're out of time. We were joined from Sweden by Dr. Jan Åberg. He's the director of the Transnational Foundation for Peace and Future Research. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
U.S. Ambassador to Germany Rick Grenell yesterday urged Berlin to block Iran's request to withdraw $350 million in cash from German banks and send it to Iran before sanctions take effect. Grenell came under fire a month ago after he said that he was seeking to boost anti-establishment parties around Europe. Many German politicians have called for him to be expelled from the country. We're joined from Washington by Medea Benjamin. She's a legendary anti-war and anti-torture activist who is the co-founder of Code Pink and an author. Her most recent book is Inside Iran, The Real History and Politics of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Medea, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on.
Medea, we heard before we started this segment that you're having a busy day. Where are you and what's going on?
Well, I started the day at the Department of Homeland Security, where we tried to deliver a petition asking Kristen Nielsen to resign because they can't comply with the judges with the demand that all children under five be reunited with their families. And then we went from there to Congress, where there is a display going on about how great Lockheed Martin is, and we wanted to pose the questions about all the civilians that are being killed with Lockheed Martin equipment in Yemen, and just got kicked out of there. So that's my day so far, but there's more hours in the day.
That's more productive than my day. So tell us a little bit about this this bank transfer, this $350 million in cash. Well, what is
it's this Iran's money?
It's Iran's money, yes.
Well, this is happens with the U.S. all the time, just like the Trump administration has accused Obama of having given Iran billions of dollars when it was Iran's money. It's the same thing. It's $350 million, which Iran has in a German bank belonging to the government of Iran, and now the U.S. is telling them not to allow Iran to get back their own money.
Yeah, and Rick Grenell, of course, Brian, has to put himself in the middle of every controversy.
He's busy building. He wants to build the ultra right in Europe. I mean,
well, what he said was a dog whistle.
Yeah,
these non-establishment parties that he wants to encourage. These are right wing extremist parties.
And Medea, we have this spectacle: Donald Trump going to NATO, demanding that NATO spend more of its budget on war and death and destruction and military hardware. And then you have the NATO leaders being angry that Donald Trump is treating them rudely. And at the same time, Donald Trump is trying to demand that Germany follow the dictates of the United States against its own policy, which was to support the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. It doesn't want to even end the deal at all. And yet you have the Trump administration brashly telling the Germans, basically steal Iran's money right now for no reason except for bullying purposes. Europe should stand up. I mean, like, what the heck?
Well, they totally should. You would think that with the media in Europe saying, why are we becoming the vassals of this horrible guy, Donald Trump? And when you look at the fact that the Europeans say they are desperately trying to keep this Iran deal from totally falling apart, and that they're trying to offer a package to Iran, and Iran said, well, wait a minute, this is not good enough. When you have examples like this, that Iran can't even repatriate its own money. And then on top of that, that the Europeans have not done enough to try to shelter their companies from U.S. secondary sanctions. And we know that because the companies in Europe are already pulling out of deals that they had with Iran. And then on top of that, the administration saying, we don't want other countries to buy Iranian oil, and we will work the Saudis so that they'll increase their oil production to make up for it. You know, the Europeans have to stand up and say, no, we're not going to allow you to bully us. We're not going to allow you to destroy the Iran nuclear deal that we all worked so hard for.
Medea, what can you tell us about the state of sanctions re-implementation in Europe? We've tried to discuss this here on the show a couple of times, but the Europeans haven't really said exactly what it is they're going to do. So many of us are hoping to see that they resist U.S. pressure to reinstate these sanctions. But at the same time, the price could be very, very high. What are you hearing?
Well, I'm hearing that the Europeans are talking tough and trying to give reassurances to Iran, but that when it comes down to it, they're not willing to buck Trump on this issue because there are so many other issues that they are dealing with. So I think it's a tough one. You know, you compare the U.S. economy and the damage that trade wars can do to European economies versus the benefits that some companies will get from doing business with Iran. They don't really compare with each other. So I am worried that the Europeans are not creating a banks that can be separated out from U.S. dollar, are not saying that we're going to sanction your U.S. companies that are working in Europe if you are going to sanction our companies. You know, unfortunately, the Europeans are divided, are not strong enough. There's, of course, the NATO issue that you brought up, where Donald Trump has been since the day he came in telling Europe, we want you to spend more on the military. And I'm sure there are plenty of people in the European militaries that say, great, but you know what? The European people don't want their governments to spend more on the military, and they are fighting back. So Europe is in a tough strait these days, and I don't know how much they're willing to stand up to Donald Trump.
We're speaking with Medea Benjamin after she just successfully asked questions to a Lockheed Martin gathering on Capitol Hill. If you go to Capitol Hill, I mean, the real government in the United States is the 15,000 lobbyists here who constitute the real power, the shadow government. Anywhere else in the world, it might just be called, you know, corruption, but here it's called lobbying. Medea, we're talking to Medea about the demand from the Trump administration and the U.S. ambassador to Germany that Germany not allow Iran to withdraw $350 million of its own money from a German bank. Now, again, regarding whether Germany is going to stand up, guess what? The Germans have announced that they are going to be reviewing the American request before loading this money onto an Iranian aircraft and sending it to Iran. The German Financial Supervisory Authority has announced that they will review the U.S. government's request to ban the allowing Iran to take out its own money under what's called the Banking and Money Laundering Act. So this isn't done yet. The Germans may actually capitulate, even though say Iran has done everything in accordance with its end of the bargain with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran nuclear arms deal.
But they are going to capitulate, because as soon as one country falls, there's a domino effect. The only way that you can stand up to the White House is if everybody stood up together, and they're just not.
Well, can I give you an example here? I was just in a meeting in Congress, and we're asking them, okay, what are you willing to do about Iran? And so they gave us an example that there was a request for the Congress to demand that the State Department give them a report on the effect of sanctions on Iran, on the Iranian people. And Congress voted that down. They did not even want the State Department to give them a report on what sanctions were doing. So imagine how cowed people are in Congress, that they're even afraid to get information that would maybe inform them about what the U.S.'s government is doing and how it's affecting the civilian population of Iran. They don't even want to know.
Yeah, they don't even want to know. And this is going to cause us longer and longer term problems. You know, Iran was just getting to the point where it was able to purchase spare parts to repair its fleet of commercial airliners, to repair oil facilities, to dredge its harbors, which is very important. They hadn't been dredged since the 1970s. And now the door is slammed shut. So what we're going to see is whether you like Iranian politics or not, it's the Iranian people who are going to be hurt. It's the Iranian people who now are going to have trouble importing foods and medicines and other necessities of life. And it's because, in part, the Europeans are not able to stand up to the United States.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has said that as of November 4th, after this winding down period where all these countries are being told they have to buy, they can no longer buy Iranian oil. The U.S. has just decided arbitrarily, you can't buy Iranian oil, even though Iran has complied with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. He said, Mike Pompeo says, these sanctions will be the tightest ever in history and will affect all sectors of the Iranian economy. Medea, you know, it's the use of food and medicine and that which is necessary to sustain life, to punish, collectively punish an entire people because the U.S. government doesn't like their government. It is a crime against humanity. And while, you know, the bombs bursting in air are always dramatic and bring people into the streets, sanctions are a silent killer. We know that.
Well, that's right. And it's just horrible to think of how the ordinary Iranian people are suffering because the sanctions have led to a doubling of the price of many basic goods in Iran and scarcities in things like medicines. So people are dying because of the sanctions, just like they died by the hundreds of thousands in Iraq because of the sanctions. And yet this is not being covered by the U.S. press. And I'm glad that you keep saying, Brian, despite the fact that Iran was complying, Iran did what it was supposed to do by the international community. It played the game, despite the fact that Israel has nuclear weapons, U.S. has nuclear weapons, whatever. They said, okay, we'll comply. And they did, and now they're being punished for complying. And there's talk in Iran about a military coup that would be from the right in Iran that is unhappy with Rouhani for having even gone through this exercise. So, you know, things could become much worse from the people for the people of Iran. And I think our government has absolutely no idea where this policy is leading, except they know it's leading to chaos. And I think there are some in the government, like John Bolton, that would prefer chaos in Iran and many people getting killed in Iran than to allowing the Iranian government to stay in power.
That was the voice of Medea Benjamin, who joined us from Washington. Medea is an anti-war and anti-torture activist who is the co-founder of Code Pink, and she's an author. Her most recent book is Inside Iran: The Real History and Politics of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
President Trump today pardoned two ranchers from southeastern Oregon who were sentenced to serve prison time on two separate occasions for setting brush fires to clear public lands. The return to prison of father and son Dwight and Steve Hammond sparked the 41-day occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in early 2016, in which a protester was killed and an FBI agent was charged with lying about that shooting. We're joined in studio by Walter Smolarek, Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show. Walter, good to see you.
Happy to be here.
Walter, I can't help but to think that this is a giant poke in the eye of the FBI by President Trump. These guys are still in prison. They have not yet finished their sentences. And the guidelines at the Department of Justice are such that not only do you have to finish your prison time, you then have to finish your, they call it paper, your federal probation, and you have to wait 5 years longer and show remorse. So what was behind this pardon?
I think this was a wink to the far right. I mean, the truly extreme far right, the Bundys and the people who were operating under their leadership are part of this particular strain of extreme right-wing thought in the United States that's sometimes referred to as the sovereign citizen movement. You know, this idea that each individual, like the individual has no responsibility to follow the laws of the federal government if it infringes on certain natural laws.
They don't even recognize the existence of a federal government.
Well, these are millionaire ranchers, the Bundys at least. What they were mainly complaining about in the original Bundy standoff when they had an armed confrontation. Can you imagine, like, Black Lives Matter having, well, let's have an armed standoff.
Yeah. Or the Occupy ICE movement.
The Occupy movement, which was, you know, peaceful, and the government said it was peaceful. Nonetheless, the government coordinated with every local and mayor and police department to shut down the Occupy movement. But yeah, these guys, the Bundys, were complaining mainly originally that they didn't want to pay grazing fees to the federal government. They wanted to have their thousands of cattle able to graze without having to pay a fee. In other words, taking public lands and allowing them to just maximize profit. So that was their great infringement on their democratic rights. And then they helped spark in defense of the Hammonds, the father and son who were sent to prison after they had an unauthorized fire. What they said was originally planned to be a controlled fire on their land got out of control, and a lot of federal territory was destroyed. They had a 41-day armed takeover of the Oregon Wildlife Refuge Center. I mean, an armed takeover. I mean, guys with automatic weapons.
Heavily armed.
And so their cause, for which they seized this federal property in an armed struggle, they succeeded. They succeeded now, right?
Yeah, and you know, they were actually beneficiaries of one pretty big government program, and that was the genocidal conquest of the Western United States by the U.S. federal government, right? The Bundys, the Hammonds, all these big, and these are pretty rich guys, even though they sort of portray themselves as, you know, quote unquote salt of the earth. All these big landowners out west, right? I mean, that wasn't their land. I mean, it was land that was militarily taken through brutal means by the federal government,
But not only that, but some of this land still belongs to the native nations of that area by treaty right. It wasn't just that this was like a crime that was committed 100 years ago and thus it's over. These are disputed territories, in fact. These are disputed territories because the indigenous nations of that area say it's their land, in fact. But again, let's just think about, just, you know, wrap our heads around the idea. People took up weapons and seized a federal property and held it for 41 days. If anybody came close to it, they were being confronted with armed forces of the Bundys and their colleagues. And now, as a consequence of that, Donald Trump has pardoned them. This would be unimaginable if African American community, which has, you know, a rightful, you know, Second Amendment claim to be able to protect their communities, weapons in hand.
And there is a case that is sort of exactly along the lines of what you're talking about, and that's the MOVE bombing in Philadelphia. Now, the members of the MOVE organization, which was an environmentalist organization that comes out of the tradition of the Black Liberation Movement, they weren't occupying anything. They were occupying their own home. They were exercising their right to bear arms. And what did the city government of Philadelphia do? Well, they dropped a bomb on the MOVE house, on the house where all these people were living, including a great many children. And they burned down an entire city block in a Black working class neighborhood. I mean, the discrepancy in how the federal government and the local government, the government period, responds to different forms of protest shows that they have a clear political orientation. They have a political bias. And that's when far right white protesters do something, then, you know, it's no big deal. You know, they were actually acquitted. All these guys who participated in the Malheur wildlife refuge takeover, they had their charges either dismissed or found not guilty by a jury or got, you know, a hung jury verdict. There were no consequences for this military maneuver.
No, there were none at all. And that's a pattern. I mean, this kind of thing happens all the time. And as you say, Walter, here you've got a situation where there actually were consequences, and now there are none. They were just taken away.
Yeah, that's right. And it's important just to clear up, you know, the relationship between these different cases we're talking about. So, you know, the Hammonds were the ones who were pardoned by Donald Trump. Their case was sort of the Bundys sort of latched onto that case. The Bundys themselves were involved in a similar dispute as the Hammonds with the Bureau of Land Management, the federal government agency that manages much of the land in the Western United States, owns much of the land in the Western United States. And so the Bundys, having a similar grievance, latched onto the case of the Hammonds and used that as their rationale for the takeover of the Mahler refuge.
Walter, for people on the East Coast, and maybe people almost all over the country, it's hard to sort of remember what the details were. You're making the point, though, that the Hammond ranchers were different from the Bundys. The Bundys sort of picked up on the cause because the Hammonds had been, the father and son had been sentenced to prison for arson because they set fires. They said that they were trying to do a controlled fire to stop invasive plants from coming onto their territory. There's a lot of dispute, though, about what actually happened. A lot of federal land was destroyed based on these fires that they had been starting, including there are other reports that part of this was just some big cover-up for other illegal activity that they were carrying out. What are some of the details, just to help remind the audience?
Yeah, there are some people who said that they were illegally slaughtering wildlife. There were reports that, testimony actually, that the uncle in the family, the Hammond family, said that, you should just light the whole countryside on fire. The Hammonds then would retort, well, we were setting off this, we were within our rights to set off this fire because what we were doing is trying to control invasive plant life that was encroaching on our land or the land that we use for economic activity. So there is a lot of back and forth and gray area there, I think.
Originally, the judge refused the prosecutor's demand that they be sentenced under the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996.
Right, which carries with it a mandatory minimum.
A mandatory minimum of 5 years. And the judge said that would shock the conscience of the nations. Of course, their name is Hammond and not Hamad.
That's right.
Because just think, if they had an Arab or Muslim name, this
forget
would
it. 20 years.
20 years or life.
And all those sovereign citizen people wouldn't have rallied to their cause. I mean, even though they're not like explicitly racist or white supremacist, I think obviously there's that undertone to it, even if it's not explicitly stated like some other far right groups do.
Yeah. So again, if the message here is that you can carry out an armed uprising against the federal government, seize federal property with guns, And if you have a particular cause and you have a particular political penchant, meaning in the direction of the far right, Donald Trump will find a tenderness, a place in his heart for you, and you will be pardoned. It would seem to me that would send a message to other people, other ranchers, for instance, or part of this movement. Hey, picking up the gun is a good idea. Picking up and carrying out an armed struggle against the federal government, in spite of everything we learn about how the federal government's going to come down on you like a ton of bricks, it actually works.
Yeah, the people in Charlottesville, we saw that on display there, right? I mean, there were many, many heavily armed fascists who took part in the demonstration, the quote-unquote Unite the Right demonstration. And then a couple days after, or maybe it was only just one day after the fascists, the white supremacists, carried out a terrorist attack where they rammed a car through a crowd, killed one person, Heather Hare, and injured many, many others, that Donald Trump gave a press conference when he said, oh, there are good people and there are many fine people on both sides.
We see how that worked out for the country. We're out of time. We were joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. Walter is a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned, and we'll be back in a moment.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Mark Zuckerberg is one of the wealthiest people on Earth, with a net worth of an estimated $74.2 billion. But he and his company, Facebook, have come under increasing fire for gross violations of user privacy. Should Zuckerberg resign as the head of Facebook? We're joined from San Diego by Dr. Robert Epstein. He is the senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology. Dr. Epstein, it's always great to have you.
Well, thanks. Nice to be back.
So I have to ask you right off the bat, it just seems to me as a casual observer that Mark Zuckerberg has played fast and loose with the information that his company has been collecting. It's as though he got away with it for so long. Nobody objected for so long that he just got sloppy and he got greedy and now he got caught. So where do we go from here?
Well, I think we have to speak truth to power. And that's why I published an article recently in the Daily Caller calling for Mark Zuckerberg's resignation. So, I mean, I'm quite serious about that. I wasn't joking. I think this would be good for him. I think it would be good for his company. And frankly, I think it would be good for the world if he would just step aside. Because I think as long as he's there, these practices are just going to continue. And the lying will continue. The cover-ups will continue as well. And, you know, we're paying an enormous price for the way he's mismanaging that company. And I think the time has come. I think he needs to move on.
How would it actually change anything, though? I mean,
question.
I mean, he's the founder of and the CEO of Facebook, but these practices that you have spent a good amount of time helping to expose to the broader public, and similarly in Google and other big technology companies, if he goes with his $74 billion, gosh, how do you earn $74 billion? Anyway.
He stole it from the Winklevoss twins.
How does it really change anything?
Well, we've seen actually again and again that sometimes when new leadership comes forward, and this happened at Microsoft, for example, and to a much lesser extent, I would say at Google. But sometimes when new leadership steps in, the direction of a company can change. Not only that, remember that Mark Zuckerberg is famous for his apologies. And he's been issuing those apologies since before Facebook was even founded. I mean, he's been violating people's privacy since 2003. And he just keeps doing it over and over again and keeps apologizing. That's a personality trait. So, you know, someone who succeeds him might not be that way. I think that's very, very unusual the way Zuckerberg behaves. So, again, new leadership could mean a new personality, a new kind of integrity maybe, and possibly a new direction for the company. Because a company, it needs to change direction because it is living off of the surveillance business model. If that's the only model you have for doing business, and it's the only model that Zuckerberg seems to know about, then you're going to do what he's doing over and over again. You are going to be violating the privacy of billions of people. You are going to be monetizing the data you're collecting. And that's a dishonest way to do business, as Tim Cook, the head of Apple, has said recently in multiple statements. That's not a legitimate model for doing business. This should involve, you know, products and services that you sell. All Facebook sells is us.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I think there is something to this from the psychological angle, as Dr. Epstein is pointing out. This is a part of Mark Zuckerberg's personality. He's consistently violated people's privacy from the time that he was at Harvard University. I was only half joking when I said he stole Facebook from the Winklevoss twins. I mean, that's all been well documented. Maybe this is just the way he is. It's a part of him, and it's time for a change. So, Dr. Epstein, where is this pressure for him to go really coming from? Is this from Congress? Is this from the board? Is it from the media?
I don't think he's under real pressure. I mean, again, you know, I published an article in the Daily Caller. I think I'm the first person ever to explicitly to call for his resignation. I don't think he, in general, is under pressure to resign. What I'm simply pointing out is that it would be advantageous for him to resign. He has other aspirations. For example, he has made it pretty clear that he's interested in running for president someday. I don't think he can do that, you know, in his current position.
I don't think he can be president either. He's never had a reality TV show. He's never been a B actor in Hollywood doing commercials. I just don't think he's up for the job.
Well, he is actually a legitimate. I mean, Trump. We could argue the point, but Zuckerberg really is a legitimate business person, and we know for sure how much money he's worth. And you know, whereas Trump has had a string of business failures and is mainly been selling his brand as opposed to, again, building legitimate businesses. In other words, Zuckerberg does have some qualifications to be a leader. He seems to have a social conscience. I mean, The point is, he has other aspirations. As long as he remains head of Facebook, I don't think he can pursue other avenues. Not only that, I think he's made it very clear that he and his wife plan to give away 99% of their fortune. And, you know, he's got to do what Gates did. He's got to move out into the world and start to focus on philanthropy because that's a big project in and of itself. So I think he would benefit, the world would benefit, and it is possible someone, you know, succeeding him would have a different kind of personality, would not play these games, and also could figure out how to transition Facebook from the surveillance business model, which harms everybody and harms humanity, to a more legitimate business model. There are some people at Google, for example, who are trying to do that now. They're actually trying to develop and sell real products instead of just selling us. But you need new leadership at Facebook for it to turn that corner.
Dr. Robert Epstein is our guest. If he gave up 99% of his $74.2 billion, what is 1%? I don't have my calculator. What's 1% of $74.2 billion?
It's still almost a billion, so it's...
Yeah, it's $740 million. Wow. Can he get by, though? That's the question. If he resigns and gives up 99% of his wealth. Let's talk in our last 2 minutes, Dr. Epstein, because there is a bigger... in a way, much more important question than Zuckerberg the person, even though that's not unimportant, which is, again, we are the commodity. We are the product in Facebook. And if Zuckerberg leaves and people want to use social media platforms to communicate like Facebook or Facebook, how can we have an adjustment in society so that we're not simply commodities, our existence commodities, for the benefit of corporations? You had raised before that this should be a utility, that this should be managed as a utility. Anyway, what's the big picture here?
Well, you know, there is a big picture, and I'm not the only one who's describing it. Vanity Fair has a new piece about Sir Tim Berners-Lee, who invented the World Wide Web, and who's really appalled at what has happened to the internet. He says it's basically become anti-human. And, you know, he and other people are working on trying to reinvent the internet. And the fact is, a social media platform that was not selling us, but simply allowing us to communicate with each other, that's legitimate. And again, Berners-Lee and others, they're actually trying to reinvent the internet and to create services like that that don't sell us, that don't track us. I mean, there are public libraries, right? The public libraries help us find information, but they don't keep track of everything that we borrow and then sell that information, monetize that information. So the internet can be reinvented, but again, that's just not going to happen as long as someone as young and as ambitious and as determined and as greedy as Mark Zuckerberg is still, you know, at the helm of a company like Facebook. So change has to occur. It has to come. And I'm saying one small step for humankind would be for him to step aside. There are other ways that the internet can be set up to serve all of us.
Indeed.
That was the voice of Dr. Robert Epstein. Dr. Epstein is the senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.